From a secret location in room 100 of 540 Jack Gibbs Boulevard, this is Craft. I'm your host, Doug Dangler. I'm here today with professor, adventurer, and author Kara Cooney, who is in town to talk to the Archaeological Society about her background, some of her research, and her most recent book, The Woman Who Would Be King. So welcome, Kara Cooney.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
You're a professor at the UCLA Department of Near Eastern Languages and Culture. UCLA's magazine quoted you as follows: "We Egyptologists have written a history of monuments of things and forgotten to write a history of the persons, the decisions, the emotions, the tribulations." So that was my intent, I believe, with your research. Tell me how this works out in your most recent work, The Woman Who Would Be King.
Normally my archaeological work is very thorough, very detailed, very data-driven, and I'm crossing all of my T's and dotting all of my I's, and I'm focusing on the things. But this book was a real pause for me. I wanted to try to pull more of the humanity in from ancient Egypt as much as possible. And so I took all that I knew about Hatshepsut, using all of the scholarship that I could find about this amazing and extraordinary woman, and then I tried to look at the circumstances, and through my own conjecture and my own understanding of what happened in a particular moment in time, I then tried to think how she might have felt, what the human emotions might have been in a given circumstance, which is not academically driven, and it's something that I published this book under Kara Cooney, which is my TV name, and my academic work is Kathleen Cooney, so I actually used a different name for this book to make it clear that this is meant to be popular and fun and sexy and human and lively. So,
are you saying that popular, fun, sexy, and human is not academic?
I'm saying that if you don't have the evidence for the sexy and the fun and the human, then most academics won't write it down. And they won't talk about it. But I want to understand that the ancient Egyptians were real people with real emotions, and I want to look at Hatshepsut in particular and look at her decision-making process. And I want that to be emotionally driven, ambitiously driven, gender-driven. So I tried to put her into these different circumstances and then imagine what it would have felt like or what her scheming would have led her to do at certain times. There's a great deal of conjecture in mm-hmm. this book, and I'm pretty upfront about that.
Right, because I think most of the iconography that was set up after or during her lifetime is gone, right?
Yeah.
So how did you research this? What was your avenue?
Well, it's interesting. So the iconography is gone, but they didn't ever erase her completely. In fact, she built so much that it would have taken an extraordinary amount of energy for the people who came after to wipe away her temples completely or wipe away her statuary completely. For the statuary, the Metropolitan Museum of Art found bits of statues, some as small as this, some as large as, you know, big chunks of rock, and they slowly glued them and pieced them back together. And now if you go to New York today, you can see dozens of statues of Hatshepsut that the Metropolitan put back together with inscriptions and all of that information. Now, the reliefs on the temple walls, they have been chiseled down, but they were chiseled down in such a way that you can usually see the old relief and text underneath. So you can see where her names were and what the images were. So you can still piece it together.
Do you think they were chiseled down so that they could be reconstructed almost in purpose, or was that just completely accidental?
The statuary is interesting because these statues are made of very expensive and hard stones. And later in Egyptian history, we would have seen reuse of that statuary, where they would have taken out a name and put in another name. And she is depicting herself as a man in most of these statues, so it would make sense that they would reuse them, but they didn't. They smashed them. The reliefs, on the other hand, where she's also mostly depicted as a man, they take out her form, and then they reassign that form or that space or that name to a king that ruled previously, either her father or her husband. So they're trying to reuse and reincorporate that temple space just without her. They don't want her haunting the walls of those temples.
So one of the things that I thought about with this is that there's got to be a lot of sort of connections between how women were treated as rulers then and connections to how women are treated as rulers now, right? Especially with the elections coming up in the United States. So what kind of lessons would you draw from what you've learned about her reign to, you know, the possibility of females empowered today?
I teach a class at UCLA called Women in Power in the Ancient World, and we track different cultures, geographies, and women to see where women ruled in antiquity, how they got there, and what happened to them. And in every single case, it's crisis that brings them to the throne. It's a lack of men. They're there as placeholders or stopgaps, and they usually have a bad end. They're at the end of a dynasty, or they're with their death, the dynasty stops, or they're just a placeholder for another man to come in later on. And in each case, the woman is swept aside. In each case, the woman has no genetic legacy. And in each case, Hatshepsut included, her ambition is judged as self-serving and dangerous. And I think that we feel this way without even thinking about it. And I find that very interesting. I'm very interested in the biological reasons for that, potential biological reasons, psychological reasons, for why a woman cannot be nakedly ambitious. And two examples. Hillary Clinton once said that if a woman has pictures of her family in her office, then people come in and say, are you just thinking about your family? Are you doing your job? You have pictures of your family everywhere. What's the point? A man needs to have pictures of his family so that he doesn't seem egotistically driven and too pompous or self-serving, so that grounds him. But for a woman, it makes people concerned in many cases. And then the other example is the recent CEO of Yahoo when she had a baby. And everyone freaked out because they thought, oh, she's not going to, Melissa Meyer, she's not going to do her job anymore. She's not going to pay attention. She's going to be paying attention to this baby. She's not capable of being CEO and having a baby simultaneously. And just that perspective right there encapsulates a lot of our mistrust about a woman's ability to be a woman, a breeding woman, a sexual woman, an attractive woman, or if she's older, a woman that has a family and wants to take care of that family and have farther connections to power. Does that make sense?
Oh, it totally makes sense. It's depressing.
It is depressing. I'd rather call a spade a spade. I'd rather see the biological and psychological reactions that we have. I'd rather feel those gut reactions and know that they're there so that they can't be transcended, rather than willfully ignoring their existence.
Unlike Craig Ferguson, I didn't trust myself to really throw the name down.
Yeah, it's hard. Hatshepsut.
Hatshepsut. I imagine he has more people than I do.
The fact that we can't pronounce it is essential to my argument, that we remember Jezebel, we remember Cleopatra, we remember Boudica, we remember the women who were raped and destroyed or committed suicide or whatever, but this woman who did everything right, who did it all so perfectly that she was erased, we can't even pronounce her name.
Wasn't she erased by her son?
She was erased by her nephew. And stepson. And she was so successful that it was so easy for them to take the credit and just put their own names in instead. And that is interesting to me, that we would rather, well, if you go out to a bus stop and you're like, hey, have you heard of Cleopatra? Oh yeah, I've heard of Cleopatra. What about Hatshepsut? No clue what you're talking about. Cleopatra, Jezebel, they've invaded our cultural psyche. There are names and stories that we like to tell. We like to tell the stories of dangerous women who got it all wrong. Nice cautionary tales. But we don't like to tell the stories of women who got it all right.
You've been called the female Indiana Jones, which I found I didn't care for, I have to say, because I looked at it and I thought, well, why does she have to be the female Indiana Jones? Yeah. She can stand on her own with her own research and her own take on things. So tell me about your reaction to that nickname.
Well, the female Indiana Jones, I am not the female Indiana Jones, and I don't think I'd want to put myself into that rubric, because Indiana Jones, there's a bunch of articles about what his actual academic life was like. Mm-hmm. He missed office hours. He was never there for exams. He missed his own tenure meeting. I mean, just he's the adventurer. He's the testosterone-driven guy who's violently taking to bring back to a museum. That's exactly the opposite of how I want my work to be perceived. But it's a case in point to say the female Indiana Jones. Where's the female model? Can't say Lara Croft, because Indiana Jones doesn't exist either, but she's over-sexualized and there's a different kind of rape of the archaeological world. Okay. So yeah, it's a tough one. It's a tough one. But yeah.
Well, on better ground, on happier ground, you also host the Discovery Channel's Out of Egypt series. Mm-hmm. And do you have new shows coming out from the Discovery Channel? What's next on the horizon?
Well, how real do you want me to be with this?
Oh, totally real.
Totally real? Yeah, the Discovery Show was wonderful. It was like a second PhD for me. It was pretty amazing. We traveled all over the world, Vietnam, Sri Lanka, Mexico, Peru, Cambodia, Italy, Turkey. It was amazing. Of course, Egypt, Israel, Palestine as well. And then we put that show together, complicated, cerebral, really sharp and fast kind of show, and it was considered too educational for Discovery. And Discovery is, and History and Nat Geo are very much about the sensational, number one, and about reality, number two. And so I don't see myself going into television again until there's more avenues for the kinds of smart, fast-paced shows that I'd be interested in doing. So I don't know if you can really use that, but that's my honest answer.
That's fine. Yeah. Tell me about balancing being an academic and, you know, somebody who's out in the media, writing a fast-paced book or a fun book like you described, because that seems like you've got two really conflicting moments.
No, it's true. I happen to be a person who's good at communicating complicated topics and to the public, and I'm good at trying to bring the past and the people of the past to life, and I enjoy doing that. And I always try to keep those two streams running simultaneous to each other. And in fact, my work in the popular sector helps my hardcore academic work, and vice versa. It makes me think in a different way, and it adds creativity across the boundaries. Having said that, I don't expect this book to count for my promotions at UCLA. It was a labor of love. It was a pause, and it's very much a time travel book for me, trying to put myself into the mind of this woman and try to figure out what her decision making process was and why women are pushed up against these obstacles continuously. But let's wait and see, because I also should say that at UCLA, I'm arguably in one of the best places to come up with a popular but smart book like this and have it complement my more serious academic work.
Okay. Because, you know,
But I'll get flack.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The Egyptologists will be out with their knives. Well, and you look at, I don't read the reviews anymore because I can't deal with the Amazon reviews, but some of the reviews will say, oh my God, this book is just like a novel. Who does she think she is? This is ridiculous. She's just making things up. And then another review will say, this is too academic. What's with all the endnotes? I can't deal with all these details. And so I can't. So I just wrote it the way I needed to write it. And it's definitely it. It's there. I don't know of anything else out there like this. Right. In ancient historical studies, not in my field.
Okay, so, yeah.
What got you into ancient historical studies? Let's start with that, or go there, because is it the artifacts? Is it the folklore? How did you end up in Egyptology?
This is a question. So I'm asked all the time why I study Egyptology, and this is actually the most difficult question for me to answer. It's the most emotionally driven, and it's a question that I have a hard time understanding myself. I see myself, you know how you have that part of yourself that watches what you do? Mm. And I watch what I do, and I think, well, this is, you know, there's a part of me that goes, this is very strange, a little aberrant, a little bizarre, that this woman would be so interested in these people who lived 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years ago. I have a hard time explaining it myself.
I don't think it's any more aberrant than anybody who has an interest in history. I mean, but it's always curious to me why somebody is interested in a particular time period, because I look at a lot of different time periods. I'm fascinated by the 18th century, not by the literature.
But can you say why?
I can't. I think some of it is just like the bizarre but interesting technologies that existed at the time, you know, the beginning of a lot of other technologies, things like that that interested me. But no, I mean, I grew up as a kid with my wallpaper was the Civil War, the Revolutionary War.
Yeah.
Right. So there's like, when did this, you know, the beginnings of that, the beginnings of all, so many other things. No, I can't explain it, but I can point to certain points in my life in which I say, I don't know how I ended up with that wallpaper. I remember that I got to choose it. And that probably marked me at a very young age as a geek.
Yeah.
and from there.
Yeah.
This.
I mean, Egypt has so many things that fascinate me and that I can follow. I think one of the reasons Egypt is so enticing to me is that I can ask difficult questions about these ancient people, and for the most part, I can make a start at getting an answer. Mm-hmm. Whereas, say I was studying Stonehenge, and there's the stones, and you track, you know, what other henges they're connected to, but there's no texts. There's no reliefs, there's no images, there's no letters, there's none of the... Egypt has preserved so much in terms of religious artifacts, daily life artifacts, homes, temples, the people themselves with all of the mummies and all of that forensic archaeology. The kinds of complicated questions I can ask about humanity and the kinds of answers I can get back are beyond satisfying. So I can really push the boundary. And in my other work right now, I'm working on the collapse of the Bronze Age, and I'm looking at coffin reuse. And I've been traveling around museums all over Europe and the United States looking for coffins of a particular time period to see if they're reused, if they've taken a body out and put another body back in and replastered it and repainted it and refashioned it to make it appropriate for that time period. And I can ask very complicated questions, and there's the data. Sometimes I have the body, I have the coffin, I have the reuse. I can see the economic scarcity in front of my eyes. I can see people unwilling to give up this religious materiality, even if they can't find the wood, a fresh piece of wood. And I can see them negotiating that scarcity right there in the object. And that is awesome to me.
How do you do things like, you said that they would replaster, repaint. How do you find out what's underneath it without destruction?
Yeah, I there are many times when I want to take a chisel to an ancient coffin, but I do not
let's
do that.
Let's just see what's there.
No, I actually have to wait for bits of plaster to fall off. So I have to be very opportunistic. Let me say that a different way. So I have to, essentially what I do is I get my flashlight and I crawl around a coffin if it's on the floor, or I'm, you know, just hovering over it if it's on a raised table, and I'm looking at every little spot where plaster may have broken off. And sometimes I find that perfect piece where I see the old decoration underneath. Sometimes it's a little bit more tricky where I see chisel marks and then I see plaster going over, and they're very rough chisel marks, and I think, that could be some reuse there. Sometimes I see a lid and a trough that don't fit, but somebody made a trough to fit a different lid. And so there's many ways of finding evidence of reuse without seeing old decoration underneath.
But hopefully somebody brushes up against it, hits it with something, and plaster falls off for you.
Well, I mean, plaster on wood is always a delicate thing. There will always be places on a plastered and painted coffin where bits of plaster have fallen off. So I have to.
So I'm going to get a metal coffin, you know, to frustrate people like you in the
or just have yourself burned, because really you don't want me finding you.
Well, since we've gone a little gruesome and we're close to Halloween, with its Halloween obviously has a lot of interest in spirits and wizardry and all the. I was thinking of the mummy movies and things like that. Have you had any experiences that made you think, geez, that was really weird in this tomb that makes for a great ghost story for people that you talk to?
Yeah, I don't work in tombs much anymore. When I do, I go in search of coffins. But I once was in a tomb at the site of Deir el-Medina, and this is for my dissertation work. So I was probably, 28 years old, and I'm going down there by myself. Actually, the inspector was right behind me. Every you get assigned an inspector, right, when you're coming in to do archaeological work, and I have my inspector behind me. And I'm shining my flashlight around. I see a big pile of coffins over here. I see some pots over there, and I shine the flashlight over here, and it was just a giant mound of dead people, you know, just... arms here, legs there, heads
How
there.
How recently?
They
like
were
mummies?
Mummies, yes. Okay. Bones and mummified bodies, probably about 3,000 years old. And I study this village. This is the village where I look at letters and receipts and divorce documents and all of those, that detritus of daily life. And then I looked, and there were the people who wrote those documents, and it wasn't a scary moment. It was just a moment where I was like, oh, the humanity of all, because you know you're looking at the books and you're thinking, oh, okay, working with this text, to actually go into a place and see the people who wrote those texts that I've been dealing with for so many years was quite visceral and extraordinary and hit me in a way that I didn't really expect.
How does a pile of corpses survive for 3,000 years?
Oh, in Egypt, everything survives. That's why Egypt is wonderful. In Egypt, dried fruit survives. So you go into a tomb and you find little pieces of dumb palm fruit or dates, and they look like they're, you know, over-sulfured from Trader Joe's. I mean, it's Or unsulfured. Unsulfured from Trader Joe's. I mean, it's
a great ad for Trader Joe's.
Bread survives from ancient Egypt. When you take away moisture and it's dry, and I mean bone dry, and you put these daily life things into a tomb and then you seal it, you would be amazed at what survives and what is not eaten by insects, because insects need, and bacteria, they need water.
Well, that's all very interesting. Thank you very much for being here today on Craft, and I hope everything goes well today with your talk.
Thanks for having me on the show.